you know, from my standpoint, it's all about, you know, how profitable can we be on this farm? The farm needs to pay for itself. You know, we can't keep funding it from our day jobs and that kind of a thing. Yeah, almost every row crop or grain crop that we grow, we're looking at what comes after it or even what comes before and how can we utilize the cattle on that.
Welcome to the 375th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. When I visited Hoosier Ridge Ranch during a recent field day sponsored by the Land Stewardship Project and Practical Farmers of Iowa, I was struck at how closely interlinked the operation's livestock and cropping enterprises are. That's no accident. Owners Eric and Michelle Hines see such a blending of hooves and plants as the key to producing food on these rugged acres in southeastern Minnesota's Winona County. And the glue that connects those dots is grazing. In fact, although Eric estimates they've grown 10 different crops on these owned and rented acres, he doesn't consider himself a crop farmer per se. He's always thinking about how growing even an annual crop will fit into his grazing enterprise. Such a management strategy requires playing the long game and doing multi-year, multi-enterprise type planning. Eric grew up on a dairy farm, and when he launched his own agricultural enterprise, he was certain of two things. He didn't want to run a lot of heavy machinery, and he wanted to farm in a way that built soil health and protected water quality on these acres, which are highly erodible. That's why he and Michelle's Driftless Region Farm is centered around managed rotational grazing of permanent pastures and annual row crops. But Eric was also trained as an accountant, so he makes it clear that all these dots must also connect financially in the long term. He's developed an impressive, straightforward summary comparing the economics of grazing cattle with raising corn and soybeans on the same land. He's even crunched the numbers on custom grazing other farmers' animals on Hoosier Ridge's acres, something he and Michelle do. Talking with Eric, it's clear he's constantly asking himself a simple question. Why not? Why not graze a neighbor's land that hasn't had livestock on it for some time? Or why not help natural resource professionals improve natural habitat by rotating cattle through a Department of Natural Resources prairie? After the Hoosier Ridge field day, I sat down with Eric to talk through some of the financials he's worked up around setting up and executing a farming operation based on managed rotational grazing. We also chatted about the importance of asking those why not questions when it comes to pursuing regenerative livestock production.
So we've got, like you said, we focus on grazing. So we've got about 65 acres of permanent pasture. We've got about 275 acres of tillable land that is in various crops from sweet corn to peas, soybeans, barley, oats, hay ground, and Kearns is an experimental crop we're trying this year. Out of that 275 tillable, we've got about 125 acres that's fenced off. So it allows us the ability to graze cover crops or graze residues and bale graze on that land when we're able to.
You said, I think you had mentioned you'd grown up on a dairy farm, and when you decided to go into farming yourself, you really, I think it sounded like there was a couple priorities for you. One of them is you really didn't want to work with a lot of equipment, didn't want to do the big crop farming thing, and so that's what seemed like that was an attraction to grazing, but it sounds like maybe some environmental stewardship issues or something that drives you as well.
Yeah, that's right. I did grow up on a dairy farm. They sold the dairy cattle when I was about 12. So at that point, you know, I was just working on other farms and stuff through high school and college. But then once we got the opportunity to farm ourselves, which has always been a long-term goal of mine, yeah, you're right. The equipment side doesn't interest me. I don't want to be a big 1,000-acre crop farmer. I want to try to be low capital, not have all this equipment sit around that only gets used a little bit every year. And so grazing allows us to do that. And obviously there is environmental factors there too. Like the ground that we own here and a lot of the ground that we rent is highly erodible land, and so it allows us the opportunity to be conservationists, create habitat as well, and really watch out for water quality too, because we don't have the erosion problems then.
Yeah, well, I can vouch for that because it has been pouring rain, and it's pouring rain right now. Maybe you can hear it. It's from what I can tell, and we walked out in the field, and I could tell it, the ground is, that soil is soaking up that, and you're not seeing erosion on this thing. It's really good to see this cover in this area. So one of the things, Eric, that you talked about, and I think you gave a really good rundown of the economics of grazing. I thought it was a really good nuts and bolts explanation of per acre, what am I making off of this by grazing, as opposed to, say, putting it in corn and beans. I guess start out talking a little bit about the basics. You have how big is your cow-calf herd?
About 30 head.
Yeah, so you have a 30 head cow-calf herd, and you've really kind of, you crunched the number. We should point out, it makes sense because you have a background in accounting. You studied accounting and you've worked in that area. So it really shows you've been able to crunch those numbers, and I think that's really key, because a lot of people love the idea of grazing, like that idea of farming, love the stewardship aspect of it, but then maybe don't look at the financials and the crunching numbers. But it sounds like you really have crunched those numbers. Can you just go through that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, from my standpoint, it's all about, you know, how profitable can we be on this farm? The farm needs to pay for itself. You know, we can't keep funding it from our day jobs and that kind of a thing. And so when I start looking at it, you know, there's sort of two different aspects. One, if you're sort of feeding out your own cattle, raising your own cattle, or if you want to do something called custom grazing, where you raise cattle for other people. And so with that, you know, you look at everything that you would for your normal crops that you grow. So you're going to have rent payments. You're going to have a whole list of other expenses. But the nice thing about grazing is you get to eliminate a lot of that. You're not going to have expenses for fertilizer and chemicals. You're not going to have tillage. You're not going to have seeding costs. You're not going to have seed costs. So you get to eliminate that. Your revenues aren't going to be as high, or your gross revenues as high as like a corn crop or a soybean crop or something like that, but you don't need it to be because your expenses aren't that high. So for example, you know, expenses on grazing that I've calculated with like a $240 an acre rent are about $340 per acre for expense, as compared to for corn, that expense is $962 for my cost, that kind of a thing. And so, you know, then where does it look on the revenue side? Well, if you're custom grazing, for example, raising other people's cattle, we always estimate that you can run 2 1,000-pound animals per acre for 180 days. And so with that, that creates a revenue of about $540 a year per acre if you're charging the $1.50 per 1,000-pound animal that we do on our farm. So with that, you get a net profit of around $220. Well, right now, it's hard to beat that for a profit. The only thing that beats that on my farm is my small square bales of hay that I sell to the horse market. That's the only thing. And think about how labor intensive that is, making small square bales of hay, how dependent it is on the weather and everything else. Whereas grazing, it's, hey, yeah, I'm going out there once a day, twice a day to check on cows, but I can do that in 15, 20 minutes. I can move my cows in that same, you know, time period and that kind of a thing. So it really can be low stress, low input, low capital investment. There are infrastructure costs that you have to bear, but when you put these pastures in, the infrastructure, likely it's going to be there for 10, 15, 20 years. So when you put that expense into it and you amortize that out for the life of the project, life of the pasture, you're coming down to some very minimal costs on an annual basis. Yes, that's going to be cash out the door, but I still think in most cases you're going to be better off than if you're sticking the money continually into row crops and hoping that the commodity market's there to support you when you want to sell it.
Yeah, and one of the things you talked about, so you're grass-finished beef and you direct market, and so you know that you're going to, you know, you're getting a certain amount per pound for that, and so you're able to then track that back a little bit and look at, okay, so if I'm putting on so many pounds per day, or then that's how much you can really figure out, well, and then this is what I'm going to sell it for, this is how much money I'm making per pound on a daily basis with that grazing.
That's right. Yeah. And so I gave the custom grazing example. If we're looking at the animals that we're finishing out, we know that we can put about 1 pound a day of hanging weight on our steers. We've got the data. We've seen that we can do really close to that on average. With that, we get $4.50 a pound hanging weight when we sell our direct market, our steers. And so that's $4.50 a day that I've got those steers grazing. So I'm earning $4.50 a day, and I can graze 1.5 big steers, give or take. So now you're at, you know, $6 and some change every day. Now all of a sudden, when you start looking at the math there, you're at $800 to $1,000 gross revenue on that acre, turning out a $450, maybe even $500 an acre profit. You know, it's pretty darn hard to beat. Now, there's risks with that because, you know, you're owning the animals, you've got to get them marketed, you've got to get them fat, you've got to do all these things. And that's where I feel we diversify quite a bit. We've got some of that ourselves. We raise our own herd, we custom graze, and then we raise all these diverse crops. So we're really trying to diversify the farm. So if there is one bad year in one segment, you know, it isn't going to sink the farm or anything like that.
You mentioned this a little bit before, but you can talk a little bit about the infrastructure costs. What was some of the major things you had to kind of get in place to get the system set up, both with the custom, but then also your it sounds like you're grazing some the crops, some of the on some crop land, that type of thing. So fencing was portable fencing, and that infrastructure must be very important for you.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there's infrastructure costs. There's no doubt about that. So you want good perimeter fence. You know, the things that I insist on is, you know, good high tensile fence. There's many ways to build a fence, but, you know, don't skimp on the wire. Don't skimp on the insulation of that wire. You know, you can use T-posts. You can use fiberglass posts. You can use treated wood posts. Do it with what you've sort of got around, whatever is going to be the most economical but still create a good fence. And then you're going to need that temporary wiring. So there's lots of different things out there, but, you know, some good poly wire, poly braided wire, good geared reels for rolling that up and rolling it out, and some good step-in posts. Like, we use O'Brien step-in posts. Those seem to be the top-notch ones out there. They make your life so much simpler. As I mentioned, there are the capital expenses here that can get, you know, add up fairly quickly, but when you allocate that across all of your acres, it really isn't that bad. And there are a lot of resources out there. Practical Farmers of Iowa has some great grants out there occasionally. NRCS does stuff. There's a lot of opportunities if you're looking to get into grazing. You've never done it before, lots of resources out there for potential grants and cost share, as well as resources, you know, from experts and people that have done it before.
So one of the things you mentioned was in converting crop ground into pasture, I think some advice that you gave was, people were like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm giving up that crop insurance coverage and everything, you know, the kind of the benefits that you get to having cropping. But you said, well, don't pick your best ground. You know, you've looked at some of the marginal ground, try it out on that first. But that sounds like that's an important strategy for you, is to kind of ease into that a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because it's a comment that I keep forgetting to mention is, you know, I'm not advocating for anybody to take their best ground that makes 300 bushel corn or anything like that and make it pasture. You know, like what we did here, we've got this highly erodible land that slopes down towards the woods edge and everything. It's rocky. It doesn't produce as well. Plus, it's next to the woods, which doesn't reproduce well anywhere. You know, so we took that ground, and that's what we put into pasture first. And so we're sort of proving that that we can make money on that ground in pasture using our marginal land, and, you know, really sort of linking that then with all kinds of other things, from cover crop grazing to some other sort of, whether you call it silvopasture or just some grassy areas in the woods, and then waterways and areas around ponds and just stuff that normally you can't get to. But now that you got cows, great, you know, we can turn the cows in there and they can take something that had no value before and make a value of it.
Do you have a particular, I'm sure it varies quite a bit depending on what the ground's like and all that, but is there a certain steps that you take when you are transferring some cropland to pasture land or that type of thing? I guess the other thing we should mention is, you made it clear, you know, it doesn't have to be permanently pasture land. Maybe you will go back into crops further down the line or whatever, but to kind of have an open mind that way.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't have to be permanent. It can be part of your rotation. You know, after 4 or 5 years, rotate it back into corn, beans, oats, barley, whatever you want. Have it back into crops for a couple of years and then bring it back into pasture. And that's sort of the bonus. If you fence off a large chunk of tillable land, you can use it as part of your rotation just like anything else. I mentioned this during the field day today that, you know, your year one costs are very tricky. Everybody's got a little bit different scenario that they're dealing with, but I look at the year one establishment very similar to how you deal with establishing an alfalfa field or any type of hay field. Year one, typically you're going to underseed it with some cover crop or something that you're going to take for forage, and then maybe you get a second cutting that year of a decent crop. And so you're looking at year one, sort of a best case scenario is that it's a break even. You're going to have expenses into it, no doubt, but hopefully if you get some good timely rains and everything else, you actually come out ahead based on the forage values that you're taking off of there, and then you look to start grazing that in year two. Year one, you just don't quite have this establishment there yet from the grasses and forages that you've got planted, and so you don't want to hamper that by grazing it late in year one. You just want to wait till year two, most likely.
I think the figure you threw out was, in the last few years, you've planted 10 different kinds of crops. Is that right? Do I have that right? You can't even, it looks like you're maybe even wondering, but no, the reason I bring that up is, you said though that, so some people might think, well, he's a crop farmer, he's looking at all these different crops, but you said even with that, you're thinking of how will this fit into the grazing system.
Yeah, almost every row crop or grain crop that we grow, we're looking at what comes after it, or even what comes before, and how can we utilize the cattle on that. So let's just say it's an oat crop this year. Well, I know that, number one, I'm going to have volunteer grasses coming in, because you just inevitably do, especially with the rains that we've been getting. So volunteer grasses will be coming in quickly after that harvest. You'll have volunteer oats after the harvest. We will then plant a cover crop mix of some sort in there. We could even have the cattle grazing those volunteer grasses while we plant our cover crop. And then that cover crop will be there for fall grazing. We shoot to not feed any hay as late as possible, obviously. But the last few years, we've been around the middle of January before we have to feed any hay. And so the cover cropping and stuff is a huge aspect of that. Not only is it good for soil quality, water quality, erosion, you know, all of these big things, but I'm looking at it dollars and cents. Like every day that I can have my cattle there, like for the quantity of cattle that we have, that's a bale of hay. So every extra day that you graze is one less bale of hay I have to feed. So there's a value to have the cattle grazing, but there's an even bigger value of the decreased expense of the hay. And so, you know, the value of the cattle grazing may only be about $30 to $40 a day, but that bale of hay might cost you $60 or $70. Either way, it's a win-win, because you've got the value of the cattle out there grazing, whether they're your cattle or somebody else's. And then one less day of feeding hay is really important. So the longer you can have them on cover crops or on stockpiled pastures and stuff like that, the better.
Yeah, and I think one example, because kerns is one of the crops you raise, and I've done a lot of interviews with farmers who, it's a really exciting thing to have this idea of a perennial grain, but the market has been a real problem, getting that stuff marketed. So for the farmers who are only looking at the grain revenue end of it, they're really concerned. But for the ones that have livestock, it's a source of forage, both with the hay and the grazing. So that's an example where you can, it's almost like a crop insurance for something like that, where, you know, maybe I'm not getting my grain marketed right away, but I know that I can get revenue through the grazing and the forage, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so Kernza, we've got about 11 acres of Kernza, and we strategically planted it right next to a field that's fenced. So that way when we graze this field, all we have to do is put up some temporary fencing to run the cattle on it. So this is our first year with Kernza. It looks pretty good. It's probably borderline on whether it'll make good grain or enough grain to make it profitable, or if we cut it for hay this first year. We'll sort of wait and see in the next couple weeks how everything looks. Regardless, yes, it's got that grazing opportunity, and that's where farmers that have the cattle can really bank this. You know, yes, I think the grain can be profitable as long as the marketing is there, but it has the opportunity to graze quickly in the spring if you'd like, and then graze in the fall after harvest and after it rebounds. And then there's also a straw, which is essentially just low quality grass that comes off of that can be used for at least some level of feed. And so it's got multiple benefits for that cattle farmer if they've got the ground.
Can you just, what are the 10 crops that you, is Kernza, barley?
So just over the last few years, we've planted soybeans, oats, barley, canola, various different hay crops, Kernza, sweet corn, peas, sandfoin. That's, I think, everything. There could be something I'm forgetting. But yeah, I mean, the biggest thing here is we're just trying to find what works for our operation. We've sort of got this 5-year goal. We're in year 3 of it, of, you know, getting a bunch of debt paid off on the farm and just figuring out what works for us. We're still learning. I mean, that's the reason why everybody was here today. I'm learning. Everybody else here is here to learn. And we had a lot of great questions, and some of it about the crop rotation that we have. And it's just, I don't think you ever stop learning. If you do, then you're probably screwing up. But
yeah. Well, one of the great questions, somebody said, well, what, I guess, have you had some kind of, not disasters, but had some setbacks or whatever? And you said you've learned about kind of taking things slowly. That sounds like there's been some important lessons you've learned around that.
Yeah, I think, you know, as any, I'm still classified as a beginning farmer. Yeah, we've been messing around with this stuff for almost 10 years, you know, from the time that we started with just 4 beef heifers, you know, and so we're about 10 years into this thing. And yeah, we've made mistakes trying to sort of grow too fast, thinking, oh yeah, we need to get bigger, or we need to do this. And in reality, we maybe have gone too fast on things. And so I think just slowing down, definitely got to know your numbers before you jump into something. Because the biggest thing is, you know, your farm is a business. It has to be profitable. And we're working towards that. And, you know, we don't have it all figured out, but we're really leaning on the things that we do know. And part of that is grazing. I mean, grazing time in and time out so far in the last several years has been consistent. The commodity markets have not been, or consistently down, I guess, maybe. Yeah. But I can't sit here and say it's the answer, otherwise I'd have 100% of our acres in it. But I do believe there's a lot of opportunity there.
How long have you been kind of doing this grazing system, or how long have you been on, it's been on this farm specifically, because you were on a different place before, but how long have you been set up here like this?
Yeah, so we bought this farm in the spring of 2020. Luckily, we were renting some pasture ground right across the road. So when we bought this farm and moved away from our old pasture, so we bought this farm and put everything into pasture land. But of course, as I mentioned, you know, it takes a year to do that. So luckily, we were renting some pasture across the road that we could move our cattle onto and wait for this to get established. So like I said, that was back in 2020. And so we're in, you know, year five of this, and sort of year four of actually grazing. And, you know, we learn something new every time we build a fence, every time we put in a new pasture, every time we handle cattle, you know, every time we run the cattle through a chute and stuff, there's like, oh, let's set this up different or do that different. And that's one thing where we've learned is we can't skimp on stuff like that and just use some old gates and whatever else. And so you got to invest in a chute, get a good corral and things like that. So it just makes life a lot easier.
Can you think of one thing that you learned, one hard lesson you learned in the past year? If you can limit it to that.
Well, in the past year, in the past 5 years, I don't know, like, you know, if you've got a sick cow or a calf or something, you know, man, it's a real attractive thing to try and just split that calf out. Like, oh, I'm just going to bring this one, or I'm just going to bring these two. And man, it never works out. Like, you know, that's one thing we've learned with, you know, they're herd animals. You know, even if you got to bring them a half a mile back up to a corral, which we just had to do the other day, you just bring everybody. And it might take you a half hour longer or whatever, but it's just going to work a lot better. And so even though you think you know better this time, you just got to remember back to what worked and what didn't and make adjustments from there. But yeah, there's always something when working with cattle.
Yeah, Eric, I was talking to Christine Johnson with the local DNR office here, and you kind of have an interesting partnership with the DNR grazing 15 acres, I believe,
yeah.
of a wildlife management area. Is it right across the road here?
Yep.
Yeah, right across the road. What she mentioned to me, which I think is really key to remember about something like this, is when you come into an arrangement like that, you have to realize the farmer has certain goals and the DNR has certain goals. You have to figure out where those two can kind of dovetail a little bit. But it sounds like that has maybe been, you've been able to kind of figure that out. You've been doing it, is it the last 6 years or so?
6 or 7.
Six or 7 years. And so it sounds like that maybe has kind of worked in with your general rotation a little bit?
Yeah, it has. So as I mentioned just in the previous question, we were renting some pasture near us probably 6-7 years ago, and there was some DNR prairie ground that butted up to it, and I thought, well, this is silly. Like, why can't we graze this too? So I approached the DNR, and they said, well, yes, we do that. We just don't do it here. Evidently, in western Minnesota and northwestern Minnesota, it's fairly common. And so we started working through the process. And like you said, there's give and take. Those first few years, it was very prescribed. Like, you can't have cows on there from this time to this time and so forth. That was probably the first four or five years. And then, you know, the DNR has really started to see the benefit of having cattle on this prairie and maybe has changed their goals a little bit. And they've, you know, we've built that trust, essentially, that, you know, I've gotten a little bit more free rein in grazing the past couple of years because they understand that, you know, there's no benefit for me to overgraze something. And so, you know, we've been able to really get a lot more value even out of those pastures than we have in the past. So, I mean, we can get 3, maybe even 4 rotations across these pastures, or this pasture in particular. And that's a huge benefit because it gives our other pastures rest and allows us to run more cattle. And so, yeah, it's been a great partnership. Christine, I just called her on Monday and said, you need to come up here and look at this. Like, I mean, it might not be all the native prairie grasses and everything else that people maybe are thinking that they're going to see, but I mean, there was 6-7 different varieties of grass growing in there. You know, there's red clover, white clover, different forbs. There was, you know, it was a very diverse crop. And I know, you know, coming in, and what we've seen over the past many years is after this first grazing is when the native grasses really start to appear, the big blue stem, little blue stem, and those really start to pop through. You can see them out there now a little bit, but they really start to come in later. And, you know, in our original early days of that agreement, we did some bale grazing there, and that's what I was telling her too, that she needed to come out and look at, because you can see the circles plain as day where there's different grass varieties growing in that sort of perfect circle where the bale grazing happened many years ago. And that's definitely something that happens with bale grazing. You don't see the results overnight, even the next year. It may take 2-3 years before you fully see the impact of what that had in that spot.
She's won over. I talked to her about the bale grazing, because to be clear, what it is, it's bales that were baled from native grassland that they were grazing. So it's building up that soil biome, but also it's a way of kind of naturally reseeding that area. And she says it's really working, and it's cut down on labor that they have to do on their end and that type of thing. So it is the term win-win is used too much, but in this case, I think it is a win-win, because that benefits your cattle and that type of thing. So I'm curious with that, are you grazing those at a different, because a prairie, you know, produces, it's got the warm season, cool season, it's different than maybe a cool season pasture type of thing. Are you able to graze that in a different time of year, or is it you grazing it pretty much the time of year you would graze it normally?
Yeah, we manage it pretty normally, unless the DNR has something different in mind on what they'd like us to do. So right now, I mean, we're just doing our first pass through it. I mean, we're already almost to July, and we're just getting our first pass through that just as part of our rotation. If we had more cattle in the spring, we could get to it maybe a little quicker. That's always a struggle. It'd be nice to have an extra 20 head of cattle every spring just to get ahead of everything, but that's not always practical to get them from somebody. So, you know, we're making our first pass through that, and it's 15 acres. We've got about 19 head over there, well, plus some calves, and it wouldn't be shocking to have cattle on this 15 acres for 25 days to 30 days. There's just that much forage out there.
You can just move them right across the road? I mean, is that kind of how it works, moving them? I mean, it's close enough, right?
Yeah, so, you know, I sort of made the comment in our presentation today about connecting the dots, and a lot of that is connecting your grazing. So, yes, this is right across the road. We run the cattle down our hay strip, run them across the road to get them into these pastures. For this summer, we've got one herd that's sort of over on each side of the road, essentially, for the time being. And so, it's pretty easy to move cattle back and forth. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer, but that's how we've been working on it, is just sort of connecting all the pieces so that way we don't have to load cattle up and haul them. We can just sort of do a cattle drive sometimes. And most of the time it's incremental, so you're sort of working your way to the back. But like last Saturday, we moved our cattle from basically one end to the other end. It was about 3/4 of a mile to get them all the way back there. And, you know, so it can be quite expansive sometimes, but it's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, do you get a sense, and I think there was a question about this, one of the farmers was asking this, this native grassland forage, the quality, are you able to compare it as far as, are they getting how the quality compares to, you know, the kind of domesticated pasture that you might be grazing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't test the forages at all, but really, I mean, the barometer is how the cows are cleaning it up. Over on the DNR ground, there is a lot more forbs and different things that maybe the cattle don't typically eat. So you do see some of that where they're leaving certain things behind. But as far as the grasses go, they do seem to eat everything pretty well. We don't really necessarily shoot for the rate of gain. Like, that's not our ultimate target. We always like to get a high rate of gain, which, you know, if you were doing that, you'd always have them on the, you know, sort of a more vegetative crop. You know, this stuff over on the DNR land right now is starting to get mature. It's had it out. And so, yes, our cattle maybe aren't gaining as much per day on it, but it's serving its purpose. It's getting the weight on the cattle. It's allowing us rest on other pastures. It's reducing the hay that we have to feed in the wintertime. So it's definitely serving the purpose that we are looking for.
You mentioned connecting the dots, and I think this is an important way that I'm struck by how you are able to connect the dots, in that you told a couple stories of you're the kind of person who is, you look at a situation, it sounds like, and you go, oh, I wonder why that's not being done. And that one example you used was, there was somebody you wanted to graze some of their land, and you kind of had to track them down to find out whose land it was, because it was like, oh no, they aren't going to rent that or whatever. But you were able to track them down. And then the other example, and I talked to Christine at the DNR about this, was, and you went to them and said, well, why not graze this? And they're like, oh, okay, well, why haven't we, you know? And so they were, it was just, sometimes you have to, just because things aren't being done a certain way or whatever, doesn't mean they can't be done. And it seems like, it sounds like your approach to farming is, you're like, well, why not kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess I probably ask that a lot, like, why not? Why can't we do this? But yes, with this original pasture that we started to rent, I had called the owner. Nobody lived at the property. The owner, there were the nearest owner, there were several of them, but the nearest sibling that owned it was an hour away, and called him every year for a couple of years just to say, like, hey, would you be interested in renting it? No, we don't want to do anything with it. We don't want to mess with it. So, you know, whatever. But then I just happened to be in this guy's hometown one time and looked him up, found his address, and went and stopped in and talked to him. And after I, you know, met him in person and told him what I was trying to do, he was sort of all on board. He goes, you know, as long as we put up the fences and whatever, because it was a pasture that had been dormant for 15, 20 years, hadn't been grazed. So, you know, we jumped on it, and then that's what connected us with the DNR. But ultimately, that initial rental agreement with this person really allowed, you know, it was the stepping stone to us renting more of their farm and really making some really good connections with the family. The farm did sell, but it stayed within the family, and actually there's an aunt and a niece that own it together. The niece is from Iowa City, and then the aunt's down in Tennessee somewhere. And we really wanted to have one of them here today just to talk about, you know, how great it is to have good partners like that. And yes, they're amazing landlords. They're super supportive. You know, we told them we want to graze this farm, and they were fully on board, let us fence it right away. Very interested in what we're doing. You know, they're very interested in the soil health, so we show them all of that information. You know, they're all in sort of on the approach that we have for farming. And that's great to have partners like that that truly support your mission and what you're trying to do. And, you know, it's really made a great connection for the foreseeable future, hopefully.
And with the DNR land, you just went in, I don't know, gave them a call or went in there, but you just said, hey, there's this grass there, I graze. Is there some kind of mutual mm-hmm. partnership we could come up with that would benefit both of us, it sounds like?
Yeah, and that was essentially it. Luckily, it sounded, you know, there was sort of some leadership turnover, so it seemed like there was maybe a little bit more interest in doing things outside the box. So, yeah, it was great to sort of be the first. And like Christine mentioned during the field today, yes, there's a lot of paperwork. There's, you know, headaches around that, but we've gotten in a great cadence now. You know, every year we review it and sort of talk about goals and what they want to do and come up with a plan and go from there. But yeah, it's been a very good relationship with the DNR as well. You know, it's great to have them come out, and, you know, they do controlled burns in the area, so that I'm always just sort of in connection with them too and talking to them about that stuff. And yeah, so it's been a really good relationship so far.
The next episode of LSB's Ear to the Ground podcast will feature a conversation with Christine Johnson, an assistant area manager for Fish and Wildlife at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Christine has been working with Hoosier Ridge on a partnership where Eric and Michelle graze cattle on a DNR wildlife management area. For more on building soil health profitably, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 375 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.